This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
From WDET in Detroit, this is Created Equal with our weekly recap edition. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm joined in the studio by the producer of the show, Carrie Jr. the second.
I'm here Friday, end of the week again.
Yeah, we had a really interesting week this week. We did a series of shows, two of them,
right,
about the U.S. Census and the changes that we're going to see on the census in 2030. They're adding two racial and ethnic categories, one for Latinos or Hispanics, and a second for folks who are of Middle Eastern or North African origin. We talked with two people about what those changes mean and how it feels to be finally seen in that way by the federal government.
And while some of these groups have been advocating for this change for years, officially the government started to reinvestigate this process in 2022. They started reviewing their standards in June of that year. Then they released an initial proposal of what the changes might be in January of 2023. And after that initial proposal, they fielded around 20,000 comments and had 100 listening sessions, according to their website, the White House website. And that's kind of loosely the process through which we got these changes.
We're also going to hear a part of a conversation I had with researcher Josh Akers about land contracts in the city of Detroit and how they fit into the local housing market. But let's start with a little bit of my conversation with Maria Hinojosa of Latino USA about this new Latino/Hispanic ethnic and racial category that'll appear on the 2030 census. So I want to start with just a sense of feeling, getting a sense of the feelings that you and maybe other Latinos have about this switch that the U.S. government is going to make in the census categories. In a way, this strikes me as finally being seen after many years of not being seen. And I guess I'm curious about how that feels, what that means to Latinos here in the United States.
Well, you know, it's interesting because for me, actually, the census is political. You're not surprised, I know, Stephen,
right?
You're not. but you may be surprised by the story that I'm going to tell you. So if I'm not mistaken, it was in the late 60s when the administration of Richard Nixon, actually the Republican who resigned, actually used the category of Hispanic for the first time in the census.
Right.
Now, these were the late 1960s. They were different political times. But the point is that I decided that because this was something that Richard Nixon had done, that I would never...
It could never be good?
ever accept that term. I know. That's very funny. It's funny. You know, I joke about it when I talk about Hispanic. I'm not anybody's panic, but then I am Hispanic and I am her panic. I am everybody's panic.
Right.
So I think you're right. I think that there is, it's good to be having this conversation. But the problem, Stephen, is that where we are in terms of the complexity of Latino reality in the United States of America, this is one of several important issues that need to be talked about. And the first thing that came to mind, and I don't want to, I'm going to say it because it came to my mind,
okay,
and I'm honest, but I'm not sure I even agree with what I my mind just said too little, too late. And that's not true. It's not too little and it's not too late, but it feels that way little bit.
Why? Why does it feel that way?
Well, you know, I've been doing a show called Latino USA for 30 years now.
Yes. Yes.
And the whole ethos of the show, the reason why we were created was because at that time, in the early 90s, there was very little Latino, Latina presence on public radio,
right,
very specifically on public radio. there was a move to engage Congress and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting to acknowledge that we were not being represented. We were, in fact, invisible. Latino USA, I would say, Latino USA was taken very seriously by us, by our audience. But I would say by the powers that be, it was kind of like, oh, isn't that cute? It's another Latino program. It'll be on a couple of years and then it'll be off.
Right.
Kind of who cares? Well, we've been on the air for 30 years because what we have been talking about is the complexity of Latino and Latina reality. Like just having a radio show, a podcast, is the tip of the iceberg in terms of understanding how complex we are as a community. And what's happened over the past, let's just say, well, yeah, during the time that we've been in existence, over those 30 years, but most intensely over the past 20, and I would say deeply intensely since 2015, so yeah, almost a decade, where Latinos are somehow perceived as the problem child. So you only see us as the problem child. That is the story that the mainstream media is telling. What you're not seeing is our economic power. I don't know if you want me to go into all of this right now, but you know, I have some of the data.
Sure.
But essentially, Latinos are helping to prop up the American economy, take us out of inflation,
yeah,
keep unemployment rates down, prop up the housing industry, not only by buying new homes, but by literally building the homes, mm-hmm, everywhere around us.
Mm-hmm.
If Latino gross domestic product were measured as such, we would be in the top 7 gross domestic products in the world, competing with, for example, India. Latinas, younger than me mostly, are the most sought-after consumer group in the United States.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why? Because we are brand loyal. And because we over-index over white women and black women in terms of deciding what will be purchased in the entire household. Latinos, and I'll stop here, Stephen, and now maybe you're getting a sense of like, wow, she's really getting riled up. And that's
okay.
That's what it's about. Latinos right now, Latinos and Latinas, Latinx, Latine, we are the 2nd largest voting cohort in the United States. You notice I did not say voting block because
right,
we're not a block.
Right.
But in terms of percentage and people, we are the largest, 2nd largest voting cohort. So therefore, how we think and feel about democracy is going to determine the future of democracy in this country. So yes, this is, it's good that we're having, I mean, I'm thrilled that we're having this conversation. As you can tell, I'm very enthusiastic about this because it's not just a Latino conversation is
right,
where I'll leave it, Stephen.
Right. It's an American
conversation. It's about the whole country.
Yeah.
That's what I'm trying to say. It's about the whole country.
Yeah. So, you know, I think for a lot of people, the word Latino means one thing. Now I'm talking about non-Latinos, right? And it encompasses some things, not others. It, as you point out, invokes certain kinds of images. And then for Latinos themselves, it means something else. The key to what the census is doing here, I think, or what's significant about it, is that it is saying that Latino is a race analogous to white or black. Now, I'm really curious about whether that matters, whether that makes the Latino community more seen or properly seen than before, or whether that distinction is not as powerful as it is for black or white people.
And then we get to this point, which is the federal government saying, well, look, we're really trying to help.
I'm from the government and I'm here to help you.
Right. I'm here to help. I want you to feel seen. Okay. So I'm going to go into another level of complexity with you all on this journey with me in Detroit, right? And this is something that Detroit folks know, Detroit Latinos know. The problem is that Latino, Latina, Latinx, Latine, we are not a race.
Right, right.
We are not a race. People are going, okay, wait a second. You're blowing my mind here. I don't understand. What are you talking about?
Que pasa mi raza, see?
Right, right, exactly. Now, the thing is that, for example, just take my husband and I. My husband, born and raised in the Dominican Republic, he is African Taino with a smidge of Spanish descendant.
Okay.
Me, I'm a quarter indigenous and then mostly European, Spanish and some Italian. Now, my husband, therefore, is black and indigenous. That is a racial category. But I'm not a race, right? Like what I would be called in Mexico is mestiza, which would be a mix. Mm-hmm. So how can I be a race if I'm part indigenous but part European?
Sure.
You understand?
I do.
So and for Latinos, look, we have this, it may be considered flawed, but a way of talking about ourselves as la raza cósmica. Why? Because we are indigenous, we are European, we are black, we are Asian.
Yeah.
We are all of those things. So if you're Peruvian, Japanese, then what you can sign off as Latino here in the in the census, but it's not true. You're not a race.
Yeah.
You're actually Asian and indigenous, for example. Do you see where I'm getting at?
I do.
And also, I'm just going to leave you with this other level of complexity because I know people are like, ugh. So, you are only Latino or Latina in the United States. Oh. What are you talking about?
Right.
In other words, when I go to Mexico and people ask me, where am I from? I will say I'm Mexican or I'll say I'm a New Yorker. Uh-huh. But I would not say I'm a Latina in Mexico because everybody in Mexico is Latina, but we don't use that term. We use Latinoamericana. We use Latin American.
Wow.
So when you get to the United States and we are now all, as it were, mixed together, right? We are Salvadoran. We are Peruvian. We are Mexican. We are Colombian. We are Cuban. In the United States, now we're all mixed together. And for identity and categorization purposes, now we are Latino and Latina. But actually, we are Peruvian American, Salvadoran American, Dominican American, Puerto Rican, which is all intents. I mean,
right.
Puerto Ricans That's are born American. With American citizenship. Yeah. Now do you begin to understand that there's no way that I would be, like, let's say I'm in Argentina and people would say, ¿Y vos de dónde sos? And I would say, yo soy Latina. I would never say that.
Right, right.
But that would mean nothing. Absolutely
but here,
nothing.
But here, up till now.
But here it does have, yes.
Right, up till now on the census, you've had really two choices, right? To identify as black or white. And do you feel like either of those?
No, I would always put other.
You would always put other. Okay.
Yeah, I would always. By the way, I mean, anytime I go to any place where you have to fill out this kind of paperwork, a doctor's office, dentist, et cetera, official paperwork, I'm always just like, what am I supposed to put here? So it will make me feel better, as you said, as you started, Stephen. It will make me feel seen, but it's not really correct.
Right.
And ultimately, what we should be doing in the United States is a much more thorough, complete and complex understanding of Latino reality.
Right.
And in doing so, you know, hopefully people would be like, wow, those are really complex human beings. That's very interesting. Wow. So they come from Peru or Argentina or Guatemala or Bolivia, or wow, you mean they're not just a mass of scary people who are coming at the border wall and trying to take it down? Now you understand why some of this touches a bone, as it were.
Yeah, yeah. So let me ask you a personal question, and you can certainly say none of your business, but when the census comes up next time, will you check Latino as race? Will you participate in the kind of charade that America's asking you to participate in?
You know, there's a lot of charades that we take part in this country. I will check Latino and Latina, or Latina for my in my case. I will, but I will also, if there's an option, I should be able to check that, you know, I'm part indigenous.
Right.
It's a really important part of who I am. And by the way, Stephen, it's only going to get more complex because one of the things that's happening in this moment with the arrivals of new migrants and refugees from Latin America is that many of them only identify as indigenous.
Right.
We are witnessing an indigenous migration, which, frankly, we should all be, celebrating, applauding, being fascinated by, being interested by the arrival of indigenous people of centuries-old civilizations, mm-hmm. you know, the Quechua, the Inca, for example. Well, they're here in New York City.
Yeah.
And they're selling candy bars in the subway. And because of that, Governor Kathy Hochul decided that they needed to have the National Guard in the New York City subway.
Right, right.
So people who are arriving here now and Latinos and Latinas who have been part of this country for a while are really in the moment also reclaiming their indigeneity. And so having, the, like I said,
so that
it's
makes
really
it even
good.
More complex. Yeah,
exactly. That's exactly what I'm telling you. It makes it even more complex. My daughter identifies as Afro-Indigenous. What is she gonna say?
Yeah,
you know, again, she will participate in the charade because she's has a mom who does a show called Latino USA, and so it would be just kind of like But it's not correct, actually. And so in the attempt to do something that they should have done 30 years ago, and at 30 years now, they should have been like, oh, wow, actually, we need to kind of disaggregate this Latinidad thing, and we're going to have to get even more funky with this. That's what should have been happening now if they had done what they needed to do 30 years ago. But sadly, when it comes to issues of race, ethnicity, and power, our country has a lot to live up to. I mean, our core issue of division in this country is the fact that it still cannot recognize what it did in terms of genocide and in mm-hmm. terms of human trafficking named slavery.
Yeah. That was Maria Hinojosa, the host of Latino USA and the head of Futuro Media, talking about the change to the U.S. Census that we'll see in 2030, the addition of a Latino or Hispanic ethnic and racial category.
How it still is inaccurate for them.
I mean, that slash that they put there is a great example of how behind I think they are. I don't think anybody really identifies themselves as Hispanic anymore.
Oh, I see.
But I think they're trying to be inclusive, but it's kind of a tell that they're not really in touch with the communities involved to talk about what's a category that would make sense.
Right, and there aren't a whole lot of choices. I mean, there's six options on the form, but there's a lot more. So I'm trying to figure that out and nail that out, I'm sure, is a challenge. And still got more to go.
Still more to go. All right, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to hear from Maya Berry, who's the executive director of the Arab American Institute, about the new Middle Eastern and North African category and what kinds of changes that will bring to those communities. Stay with us for more Created Equal.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Do listening to Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm with Kerry Jr. II, the show's producer. We just heard from Maria Hinojosa about the new category on the U.S. Census for Latino Americans. Now we're going to hear about the other change.
Yes, Middle Eastern North African. That is a new racial slash ethnic category that's expected to be added to the next census. It's also known as MENA. And Maya Berry, the executive director of the Arab American Institute, does have a different take than
she really does. Yeah.
They have been advocating for this for some decades.
Yeah. And she really focuses on the research that will be possible to understand the presence of people from this part of the world in our country, but also the needs that they have and directing policy and designing policy in a way that can be responsive to those communities is something that they are anticipating will go much, much better and much smoother once people can check this category. So really different take on the whole idea of what the census is doing and what effect it can have on that community. Why do we need a MENA category on the census?
It is exceptionally important. And I was just having a conversation earlier today with a group of colleagues, and it was a discussion about how the race and ethnicity standards were revised and issued. And we kind of came around to, you know, well, is the glass half empty or is the glass half full?
Right.
And I pointed out that for the first time ever, my community has a glass. So
that is a really great way to put that, right? You just got a glass. Now you got to fill it.
Right. That's exactly right. So I think, yeah, I can't overstate the significance of finally getting to the point of having a minimum reporting category that will appear on the decennial census and all federal data collection forms. So that's the other point of this. This is bigger than just the census. Although the census is pretty darn big.
Mm-hmm.
So it's incredibly significant, and it's been decades in the making. And it's important to understand that there really is almost nothing that is not directly impacted by the federal statistical standards in terms of the way that they present information about communities, the way that the U.S. Federal government uses that data. So it's big. It's very big. And the only other point I would make is that I think as we talk about these issues, and I so appreciate the opportunity to be with you today to do that, is to kind of understand that the category itself is Middle Eastern North African. And it is, I always like to emphasize that it is a broad and diverse geographical and racially diverse category. So it's actually communities plural.
Yes, right.
it's hard to parse the language, but I think it's important to note that.
Right. It's not one community. And I do want to get back to the question of the impact and the specifics of how that matters. But let's stop on the point that you're making right now, which is that this is a very broad and diverse descriptor. Talk about how broad and diverse that is. Who would logically be among the people who would select a category like this on the census?
What an incredibly important question. And I would tell you that I'm going to answer it based on what we believe it should be answered. And it's not clear yet that is where the standards landed or that how the Census Bureau will operate.
Okay.
But the Middle East North Africa is a broad geographical category. It would include the 22 members of the Arab League, so the Arab states that are identified as Arab. It would also include non-Arab MENA, which would be Iran, Israel, Turkey. So these are countries within the Middle East and North Africa that are non-Arab. And then in addition to that, the Middle East has transnational communities. And this is a particularly important piece for Michigan, where we have the highest concentration of Chaldeans and Assyrians who are part of the Middle East and North Africa, but may not necessarily identify under an Arab umbrella. So they're transnational communities that are here in the U.S. The Armenian Americans are another example of that. Kurds are another example of that.
Wow.
So it's a pretty broad category with those main three areas. And then within that, we have to understand that as an ethnicity, Arab Americans and even MENA populations can identify with any of the racial categories. It's an ethnic category, very much like Latinos.
Mm-hmm. And when you think of the significance to this community of this glass that you have now been handed to fill. I mean, I think that's a separate question really from, what the practical implications are. And I guess one way to think of it is by asking, what have folks who have been filling out the census up until now who would describe themselves as being of the backgrounds that you just talked about, what were they doing? What were they missing in the way that they were forced to fill it out before?
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to answer it specifically with regards to Arab Americans, because that's the work that, you know, and it's important to understand that Arab Americans are the single largest segment
of
the MENA population. What we were missing is pretty much everything. you would look at a federal form. You would look at your local school's form. You would look at any time it came out, an opportunity to check a box. You would look and say, okay, I don't see myself here. How do I check this, fill this out? Mm-hmm. And I give this as an example. I tell this story. I have personally never checked any existing boxes. I've always checked other. And then within that, I've written in Arab Americans.
Okay.
Now, others may identify differently, but that's how I've done it. So in my local school districts, I have two kids. One of them, we would fill out their forms, check out other. One of them was coded as white, and the other one was coded as Asian.
Huh.
So I have two kids, and in my local school districts, they were two different racial categories. That only happens because there was no accurate way in which to gather the information about my kids in my local school district.
I see.
And you can literally take that small little example and apply it to so many other areas, from hate crime data collection to civil rights protections to EOC complaints to the way congressional districts are drawn to voting rights. There's nothing that isn't directly impacted by the ability to have accurate data on these communities. And if no checkbox, no category existed, we lingered in this space where we were rendered completely invisible within the data.
Yeah. And that gets us to these practical implications that you were kind of referring to before, the things that will be different because of data that's collected by the census. But as you point out, it's all federal data that will be collected with this new descriptor, and that it reaches really deeply into people's lives.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In addition to the fact, as you said, all federal agencies will adopt these new standards. Once the federal government has laid down this groundwork, you will see that states will begin adopting the federal standards. You will see that universities who are going to conduct research, as they do, will adopt the federal standards. It's an extraordinary breakthrough moment that we're going to see have very meaningful and improvements to people's lives. And I do think it's the reason this battle has been taking place. I shouldn't refer to it as a battle. It's the reason this effort has been underway since the founding of my organization in 1985. The first partnership we put in place with the Census Bureau was in 1990. And the first time we specifically sought to create a new category was in 1995, right before the last time the race and ethnicity standards were revised in 1997.
Yeah.
So it's been a long haul because it's one of those issues that is so directly impactful to people's lives.
Right. You described it as a battle before backing away from that language. I'm going to push you back, though, to that word, because it does seem to me like this was a battle, and it's a battle that has gone on a long time, as you point out. Tell us about why this has taken so long and what the efforts looked like to bring or drag perhaps federal officials to the point where they were willing to do it.
I so appreciate your reframe on that. And let me explain why, because I do think that's an incredibly thoughtful way to kind of think about it. I walk back the battle because at every step of the way, the Census Bureau has really understood the need to collect more accurate data about this community and has acknowledged the massive undercount that has been there. Mm-hmm. So when we made the ask back in 1995 and said we need a new category, the Office of Management and Budget, when it released those new standards, said, we heard you. There were a lot of comments submitted that you wanted this, but we need more testing. And that was highly regrettable because we went 29 years until a month ago where we got the new standards, right? So that is an unfortunate thing. But after that, you did see the Census Bureau step into the process doing what they're supposed to do, which is the statistical agency that collects this information about all people in the United States. And they began the process of research and testing that got us to a place of saying a new minimum reporting category of Middle East and North Africa will improve data collection. So for me, that piece of it has really been about policymaking in some ways working correctly. The battle part of it, and you're correct for sort of pulling that out here, is that we have been a community that has regrettably been erased in some very real and meaningful way. So our government's national security policies tend to view us as highly, highly visible and targeted. Mm-hmm. We talk about it being a securitized community where the relationship with government is at points quite honestly a difficult tension between striking the right balance between national security and our civil rights and civil liberties. So in that way, we're the canary in a coal mine to the fellow Americans here about the way that our civil liberties are handled. Mm-hmm. So you're rendered super visible in that regard, right? And goodness, we need no better example than seeing Dearborn, Michigan, and the way that the community there is targeted often with events that happen in the world completely unrelated to them.
Yes.
But then invisible in the data. The 1997 standards placed people from Middle East and North Africa exclusively under the white racial category. Yes. And that has meant that for all of these decades, the ability to get information about our community was simply not there. I would, for example, in the 2020 census, I would check other, and I would write in Arab American, or in my case, I'm of Lebanese ethnicity, I would write Lebanese national origin as Arab American ethnicity. I would still be coded as white. Mm-hmm. So even if I declaratively checked other and wrote that down, the back end would code me as white because specifically the current race and ethnicity standards then. So this is a big significant change in terms of saying we will have this checkbox. We will be able to gather the information about this community and it will produce better outcomes in people's lives. Yeah. Now, we're not done because there are a variety of concerns, frankly, with the way the standards were issued and other things that have to come up with regards to implementation and preparing for the 2030 decennial. But the idea of not having a checkbox to at least start the process is finally been improved.
Yeah, yeah. Are you surprised by the government's decision? I mean, it has been a long time and there was nothing that said they had to do it, even at this point. What do you imagine changed that produced this?
Yeah, I'm not at all surprised that we've added the category now and that the revisions of the standards had to take place. I am, frankly, surprised that we didn't get it in time for the 2020 decennial. Huh. The national content test that the Census Bureau did, which has its own issues, which we can choose to talk about or not, but that test was conducted back in 2015, and it demonstrated unequivocally that a new MENA category would improve data collection. And we thought we were in place to have that category added by the 2020 decennial. Hmm. And regretfully, that decennial census for the first time ever was politicized in an unprecedented way. So instead of getting the category in the category of a non-action is an action, without something happening, the Census Bureau simply defaulted to the questions for the 2020 census based on what they asked in 2010. And that was really quite unfortunate. Yeah. And we then had another decennial that continued to reinforce the undercount. So now I will say it's not surprising because this has been the trajectory for some time. What is important to note here is that the Biden administration came to office and with a series of executive orders has really emphasized the importance of data equity.
Yeah.
And because of that, they announced in 2022 that they would be revisiting the race and ethnicity standards. And that process has been going on. They formed an interagency working group. There was a great deal of stakeholder engagement. We were very much part of that process. And then they got to the place of issuing the standards as they did last month. And I think it's important for your listeners to know that in addition to creating this new MENA category, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, which is obviously huge, there were other really important changes. One of them being that for the first time ever, we will have a combined race and ethnicity question.
Yes.
So a respondent will look at one question and say, check all that apply.
Right.
And it will include the existing racial categories and then the two MENA and Latino ethnic categories. And I think that's very significant. And the other third bucket of major developments is a new requirement for more detailed data collection.
Yes. Yes.
It's exceptionally important to have disaggregate data about communities because that in some ways that's frankly everything.
It guides policy. I mean, at bottom, right?
It guides policies and it shows, it'll help us understand disparities that exist within communities.
Yes.
We know, for example, based on our census analysis of census data, that Arab Americans have higher home ownership rates. Mm-hmm. Arab Americans have higher education levels. There's a lot of indicators that would suggest a fairly successful economic community in that regard. And that's wonderful. That's great. So we have those profiles so we can use them. But at the same time, if you look at that only in its aggregate form, you're going to miss very specific information about perhaps a new immigrant community.
Right.
That's going to take a little bit longer to be able to achieve a level of security and success to do that. We can be looking at the same issue with regards to health research. I mean, the response to the pandemic was a perfect example of the need to make sure that we do better on data collection for all communities. Mm-hmm.
That was Maya Berry, Executive Director of the Arab American Institute, talking about the new census category for Middle Eastern and North African Americans. Stay where you are. When we come back, we're going to talk about land contracts in the city of Detroit and a new report that talks about the outcomes of those contracts over a critical time in the city's history. This is Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and we're really glad that you're with us. We're going to listen to a conversation we had with Josh Akers, who is a researcher who wrote a recent report about land contracts in the city of Detroit between 2008 and 2015 and what the outcomes of those land contracts were. The idea is to get houses into the ownership of people in Detroit who can't qualify for mortgages. Yeah. What he found, Kerry, was that it doesn't always work that way.
Yeah, these land contracts are new to me. I thought that primarily you approach buying a house through a mortgage. But from what I understand, if someone can't get a mortgage, they go through this process by getting a land contract where they're paying on the price of the home over time and eventually become the owner of the home, almost like a rent-to-buy, but not exactly the same. But what we're seeing is that those folks are actually being taken advantage of in some cases, and then they're not getting the home, and they've paid a bunch of money on it. The research that they looked at took a snapshot in time for Detroit, 2008 mm-hmm. to 2015, this seven-year period, which also overlaps with the financial crisis and Detroit's bankruptcy.
Yeah, it's the aftermath of those things and the way that they affected the housing market. You know, this is such a key indicator in the city of Detroit. the level of home ownership historically. This was one of the cities that had the highest rates of home ownership, especially for African Americans. And we've struggled to maintain that for a short time in the last decade. We were actually a majority renter city for the first time in the city's history. We're recovering from that. But, you know, the way that programs like land contracts, not that it's a program, it's just something that's happening. Mm-hmm. But the way land contracts affect that, I think, is really critical to what the city's future is going to look like in terms of housing stability and the kind of investment that creates generational wealth.
Yeah, let's take a listen.
We've got a number of folks who work in housing advocacy here in the city who are calling in. And I want to start today with two of them. Michelle Oberholzer, you are up first. Hey, Michelle.
Hi, good morning, Stephen.
Yeah, it's great to hear from you.
I have so many thoughts to share. I hope I can get a few out in the time allotted. But sure. Josh Akers, I agree with everything you said, and I can't wait to read the report. You know, we do see a lot of intentionally malicious land contracts that are designed to fail, especially as a way to sidestep the city rental ordinance. You know, it's a convenient way for owners to essentially rent without having to try to comply. It's not a new issue, though. If you are familiar with, you know, Ossian Suite or Ocean Suite, however you pronounce his name, that was a predatory land contract, you know, all back in the day. So, two other quick thoughts. I wanted to share that the City of Detroit with U of M Poverty Solutions and Enterprise Community Partners did create a website. It's called DetroitLandContractHelp.com. Mm-hmm. That's a digital resource. It has information for every stage before you sign. You know, the burden of the research is really on the buyer. So how to navigate to find out if the owner is really the owner and things like that. And then there's also printed resources in English and Spanish at a number of community nonprofits. But one last thing before I end the comments is we have identified that one problem of many, but one problem that leads to these land contracts being weaker than they might otherwise be is the fact that you can't record a land contract with the Wayne County Register of Deeds unless you have no tax debt. So whereas if you have a quitclaim deed, of course, there could be title issues, but at least you can record it. You can get the taxes in your name more easily. You can get notifications and you have that recognition. It's a little harder to just evict someone if they have a recorded title of some sort. But state law doesn't allow that unless there's no tax debt. So that's just one small thing I think could go a long way to give a little bit more transparency to what's in these land contracts.
Sure.
And to who is buying them.
Yeah. Yeah. Michelle, I really appreciate the call and the info. I should note that Michelle is a housing program and policy advisor for the city of Detroit and is someone who has worked for a really long time in housing advocacy here in Detroit. Josh Akers, I want to give you a chance to respond to these ideas that Michelle is throwing out there.
No, I mean they're all good ideas. I know where they come from. It's good to hear from you, Michelle. You know, I would say that some of the things that we need to talk about at the state level is, you know, ideas around these land contracts having independent appraisals, mm-hmm. right? And try and close some of the information asymmetry that exists there. Also, making sure that titles are held free and clear by the contract seller. That way, the contract buyer has an opportunity to successfully complete that contract. And it also doesn't allow contract sellers to take out mortgages on the property while they're under contract, which is part of what's possible given the difficulty in filing ownership claims.
Yeah. I mean, there is a sense of imbalance inherent, I think, in the process of buying a home through the land contract process, given that most buyers are not particularly savvy about, you know, these kind of things. And if you're a conventional buyer, the bank tends to be the bank and your real estate agent tend to be the kind of protection that you need from the kind of predatory behavior that you might see in some cases. When you're in a land contract, you're just kind of on your own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And that's, you know, and that's oftentimes, particularly these larger sellers, what they utilize. You're on your own. They ask for all of your financial information. They understand the, you know, the kind of financial condition of your household, and they price things accordingly, both how much they're going to charge you for a down payment, but as well as what your monthly payment would be, with the idea that, you know, anything from a flat tire to a medical emergency is going to put you behind in your contract payments, yeah, and result in your eviction.
Yeah, yeah. Again, Michelle, really appreciate your call and that info. Let's go next to Ted Phillips. He is the executive director of the United Community Housing Coalition. Ted, what's on your mind?
Hi, Stephen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I wanted to, I missed sort of the beginning of the presentation here, but I just want to say that one thing is that rent-to-own leases are very different than land contracts.
Okay.
Rent-to-own leases and our work that we do at the Housing Coalition are almost always, when we encounter them, scams. They are set up so that it's the buyer and the seller. It looks like a land contract all the way through, except for there's language there saying if you miss one rent payment, and it is captioned as a lease usually, if you miss one rent payment, even though in 5 or 10 years or whatever, you're no longer a land contract buyer, you're a tenant. The significance is that then you can be brought to court as a tenant, have to pay all your back rent, mm-hmm, or be evicted in 10 days. You have no ownership rights. You have no ability to get your name on the taxes to be able to get a homeowner rate as opposed to an investor rate. You have no right to get a poverty exemption because you're just a tenant. Whereas a land contract, even a bad land contract, gives you some ownership rights, gives you 90 to 180 days to redeem if you fall behind, and other kinds of things like that. So that's one quick thing. Other issue is that what you very often see in these land contracts is that, you know, people aren't making bad decisions. It's just that they don't have a lot of options there. And very often it'll look like it's a monthly amount that somebody can afford. It'll look like, and sometimes it's set up so that there is a balloon payment at the end. And if you do the math, if you don't do the math, you won't know that. So that's a problem. But the other issue it may become even more prevalent now as we see home values increasing so much in Detroit, is a common theme over the years has been, the house is bought for $500 to $1,000 during that period when, as Professor Akers had mentioned, 2008 to 2015. When there were all of these tax foreclosure sales. And so the prices actually, you know, were, you know, 10, 15 times what the seller paid for at auction purchase. But still, they were kind of reasonable in terms of somebody being able to own a home. But as the values increase, you see more and more efforts made by land contract sellers to find reasons to forfeit the land contract, find reasons to take them to court and get an eviction. I mean, we've got a case right now where person came to us kind of late. They bought for $50,000. They paid $66,000. And there are some sporadic payments and what have you. But the seller's trying to pretend that they suddenly became a tenant, and now they want it back. Why? Well, because the house is worth probably $100,000 or more in a particular neighborhood of 10. Yeah. I also wanted to catch one other point, which I understood. I thought someone said earlier that you don't become a tenant by missing a land contract payment. That's a fallacy that's kind of out there. Land contract sellers try to argue that all the time, but they're not successful when people are represented.
Right, right. Ted, I really appreciate you calling. That was our conversation with researcher Josh Akers, who took a look at land contracts in the city of Detroit from 2008 to 2015. Really great voices added to the conversation as well. Great housing advocates who called in to tell us about their experience with the instability in the housing market and with land contracts.
Yeah, and I feel like, you know, in the full conversation, maybe not necessarily in this snippet, we got some good calls to tell us a little bit about both sides of it, how those land contracts, if you find someone who you can trust on a personal level, could work out in favor for people who are looking to become homeowners. It's unfortunate because I can understand the desperation behind folks who want to own land.
You know, one of the questions I think still is, what the city can do, what housing advocates can do to make sure that the tool's used properly, that it's used as a means of opportunity and not a means of kind of predatory lending, which is something that people in the city suffer from all the time. That's it for Created Equal. You can listen to recent episodes at WDET.org and make sure to subscribe to our podcast where you can leave us a rating or a review. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lines. The audio editing is by Connor Anderson and the music is by Sam Bobie. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.